The disaster of the Gladden Fields stands as a most notorious event in the history of Middle-earth. A conspiracy of bad fortune and lingering Sauronic malice. Yet what if, despite the doom of Isildur and his men, it can be rightly seen as the first great victory in the War of the Ring itself? Join us as we explore the disaster of the Gladden Fields. The Tolkien Road, Episode 215, Unfinished Tales, The Disaster of the Gladden Fields, Part 2. Hello everyone, welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 215. Greta, how are you?
Hey, I'm fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yes, indeed. We have an interesting topic for everybody today.
Cool. Tell me about it. What is it?
Well, as you could tell, also, because you've done all the prep for this episode.
Oh, right. Yes.
This is the Disaster of the Gladden Fields, part two. Part two.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yes, cool. So on this episode, we are continuing our look at the Disaster of the Gladden Fields from Unfinished Tales, and that means we're going to be looking at the notes that accompany this. Now, I know what you're thinking. That sounds amazing. I'm just going to try to temper your expectations some.
Not a snore fest at all.
Right.
No.
No, in all honesty, there's actually some really interesting stuff here. It's not exactly a narrative we're looking at, but it is a bunch of notes that Christopher decided to include with the text of what we read last week. And there's actually some pretty interesting stuff in here.
Okay.
So
cool.
Yeah. There's also some bits about the exact distance as the crow flies of a Numenorean league and those sorts of things. But
of course. It wouldn't be Tolkien without that.
All of those things matter in Tolkiendom.
They do. Yep.
Before we get started, we want to give a special thanks to our patrons and especially our episode's executive producer, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien. If you would like to become a patron, head on over to patreon.com/Tolkien Road to learn more, to find out all the deets. So
do it.
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, you know, and there's not too much in the way of news worth ranting about this week.
Okay.
So I think we should just dive on in, right?
Okay. I'm down with that.
Also don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. Right.
Right. Oh, of course.
Always do that.
Of course. I think that should go without saying at this point.
Yeah.
But it never hurts to have a reminder.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right, yeah. So, let's dive on into this topic of the Disaster of the Gladden Fields, part two.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, we're picking up where we left off, which is the narrative just ended, right? So, Disaster of the Gladden Fields. Just to refresh you, this is where Isildur leaves after the defeat of Sauron at the last alliance of men and elves. Of course, Isildur fails to destroy the ring, keeps it for himself. A few years go by. He spends a few years in Gondor getting things in order there, and then he decides he's going to travel north with kind of a small army back to Arnor, right? As the High King of the High King of Arnor and Gondor at this point, he's heading back to his throne, right?
Yep.
And he wants to stop in Rivendell along the way because he wants to pick up his wife and youngest son.
Right.
So he decides to go via the Anduin route, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. So he travels basically along the eastern bank of the Anduin River with a small Numenorean force. And near the Gladden Fields is waylaid by orcs, and the Numenorean force is pretty much demolished by these orcs, and Isildur flees, attempting to save himself and save the ring from the orcs. And we all know that he is killed by the orcs, but the ring escapes his grasp in the process and is lost to history, at least for some several thousand years.
Yeah.
So
in the water.
That's right. So yep. If you want to know all the details of exactly how all that played out, you'll have to listen to the first part, episode 214. But on this episode, we're looking at all these notes, right? The notes that go along with this, and there's like 33 of them. In addition to a bunch of, several paragraphs on the sources of the legend of Isildur's death. So, you know, with Tolkien, it's never enough to just be like, well, I'm telling you that this happened and I just know it because I have godlike omniscience as the writer of this story, right? Tolkien's always got to have there's always got to be the frame narrative. There's always got to be the, like, how do we know this, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's just, again, another aspect of his verisimilitude. He writes these things as histories, and not just forced backstory to kind of flesh some things out here and there.
It's true.
So let's start with the sources of the legend of Isildur's death. So we basically know what we know because of a few eyewitnesses to all of the events. All right, because you think about it, we know that Isildur dies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we assume Isildur is never heard from again. We actually don't know whatever becomes of him, really.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And we just know that he's never heard from again. And that the ring is eventually found.
Right, but they never find his body.
Right.
And they never find his bones. They find nothing.
Right.
Of him.
Right. So we also know that very few Numenoreans seem to have survived this encounter with the orcs.
Mm-hmm.
So the way we come to know about these events is through two individuals, Otar, who is Isildur's esquire, and Estelmo, who is Elendur's esquire. So Elendur, of course, being Isildur's son.
Right.
Otar was sent by Isildur bearing some of his own artifacts before things got too bad with the orcs, right? So Otar was sent by Isildur, and then Estelmo is basically privy to everything else that goes back and forth between Isildur and Elendur. And they talked about, you know, they shared all of their thoughts with one another as everything was going south.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Estelmo, being Elendur's esquire, was privy to all of that.
Right.
So Otar and Elendur or Estelmo are the ones who survive to tell.
So we're assuming that they made it to Rivendell, and that's where they shared the story. Or do we not know that for sure?
I mean, I don't know that they made it to Rivendell per se. That may have been where they made it.
And that makes the most sense, right?
Yeah.
Because that's where they were headed anyway. And they weren't too far when all this went down. So
it would definitely make sense.
Yeah.
I suppose it's possible that they made their way to Lorien, but Rivendell seems the most likely answer. So we actually learned that Isildur's demise was surmise, right? So this was
Oh, it was surmised,
right,
that he demised.
Right.
Because they don't have any proof.
Exactly, right? Yeah. There's no body recovered or anything like that. So but the way they come about this is actually explained, right? The way they kind of arrive that Isildur most likely died was through the following things.
Mm-hmm.
Isildur had the ring and fled towards the river. That's known, right?
Yep.
His artifacts were found near the Gladden River. All right. So he did drop some things along the way, and so, you know, it's known that he passed towards the Gladden River in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
It's known that orcs left watchers on the west bank, right, on the west bank of the Anduin River, right, okay, in case somebody tried to escape that way.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right, yeah.
And then finally, that Isildur must have been lost in the river, for if Isildur had reached the west shore wearing the ring, he would have eluded the watch. And so hardy a man of great endurance could not have failed to come then to Lorien or Moria before he foundered. So it's just basically said with that last point that if Isildur had managed to escape from the orcs, right, then he would have he would have shown up somewhere, right? It's not like he would have just died somewhere in the wilderness, right?
Because that was really the last obstacle,
right,
to safety.
Yeah, he had to have been slain, in other words, right? Mm-hmm. So this wasn't a guy who was just going to be like, oh, woe is me, I can't handle the wilderness, right?
Right.
Isildur was a hardy dude. He was a strong warrior, and it's unlikely. And furthermore, he also was equipped with some special sorts of, what do you call them? Basically rations to help when he's in the wilderness.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yes.
So
yeah.
Kind of like
food.
The elves have Limbus.
Right.
The Numenoreans had something very similar. Mm-hmm. So it says the Dunedain carried in a sealed wallet on his belt a small feel of cordial and wafers of whey bread that would sustain life in him for many days. Not indeed the Miruvor or the Limbas of the Eldar, but like them, for the medicine and other arts of Numenor were potent and not yet forgotten. No belt or wallet was among the gear discarded by Isildur. So, long afterwards, of course, the ring is found, but not Isildur's body, right? So, we know that the ring is discovered, and we learn through a series of, a series of deductions and other findings that the ring was found by Dagol, in the Gladden Fields, in the area of the Gladden Fields,
mm-hmm.
Roughly 2,500 years later. Okay.
Right.
So the ring was found. And then I think this paragraph is worth reading. You want to read where it says, but King Elessar?
What note is that? I'm lost.
Right there.
Oh, okay. But King Elessar, when he was crowned in Gondor, began the reordering of his realm, and one of his first tasks was the restoration of Orthanc, where he proposed to set up again the Palantir recovered from Saruman. Then all the secrets of the tower were searched. Many things of worth were found, jewels and heirlooms of Erol, filched from Edoras by the agency of Wormtongue during King Theoden's decline, and other such things, more ancient and beautiful, from mounds and tombs far and wide. Saruman, in his degradation, had become not a dragon, but a jackdaw. At last, behind a hidden door that they could not have found or opened had not Eleazar had the aid of Gimli the dwarf, a steel closet was revealed. Maybe it had been intended to receive the ring, but it was almost bare. In a casket on a high shelf, two things were laid. One was a small case of gold attached to a fine chain. It was empty and bore no letter or token, but beyond all doubt, it had once borne the ring about Isildur's neck. Next to it lay a treasure without price, long mourned as lost forever, the Elendilmir itself, the white star of elvish crystal upon a fillet of mithril that had descended from Silmarillion to Elendil and had been taken by him as the token of royalty in the North Kingdom. Every king and the chieftains that followed him in Arnor had borne the Elendilmir down even to Eleazar himself. But through it was a jewel of great beauty. But though it was a jewel of great beauty, made by elven smiths in Imeldris for Valandil, Isildur's son, it had not the ancientry nor potency of the one that had been lost when Isildur fled into the dark and came back no more.
Yeah, so...
So they found some of his stuff in Orthanc.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, right? They find a whole bunch of his... the things that he would have been carrying with him. They find the Elendilmir itself, right? Which was obviously something that he would have been loath to leave behind, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they say, okay, well then, you know, obviously he met his demise somewhere in the wilderness, right? And then these things were later found, okay?
It's still so strange mm-hmm. that they found those things,
mm-hmm.
but not his body.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's clear that the Elendilmir was on him
right.
when he was killed. Remember, because we talked last time mm-hmm. about how that's probably why he was killed.
Right.
Because he was invisible with the exception of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was clearly on his body.
Right.
So it's just so strange that that was found, but his body never was.
Well, it goes on to say, When men considered this secret hoard more closely, they were dismayed, for it seemed to them that these things, and certainly the Elendilmir, could not have been found unless they had been upon Isildur's body when he sank. But if that had been in deep water of strong flow, they would in time have been swept far away. Therefore Isildur must have fallen not into the deep stream, but into shallow water, no more than shoulder high. Why then, though an age had passed, were there no traces of his bones? Had Sauron found them and scorned them, burned them with dishonor in one of his furnaces? If that were so, it was a shameful deed, but not his worst. So, we'll never know what became of Isildur's remains. We get a little bit of a conjecture here that maybe Sauron did something very dishonorable to them. But at the very least, we can know with pretty reasonable certainty that that Isildur, he perished in the Gladden Fields, and his body was eventually found there along with these artifacts, right? Like the Elendilmir.
Right.
So
yeah.
So that's how we know. That's how we have the knowledge that we have of Isildur's likely demise. So
yeah.
Yeah.
I don't quite understand this one piece here where it's saying that he must have fallen not into the deep stream, but into shallow water, no more than shoulder high.
Well, if he had fallen into a deep stream, then he would have been swept away. Like his remains would have been swept away, right? You think about if you fall into a deep river, right? Eventually, you're going to get carried away, right?
So they're saying that those things would not have been able to be found. Those relics wouldn't have been found had he have fallen in deeper water.
Right.
That makes sense. Because like the ring, they would have been hiding deep in the deep somewhere.
Right.
Okay.
Or if they had been carried away down the Anduin, then, eventually, that means they would have passed through, these things would have passed through like Osgiliath, right? Which means that there's a chance that they would have eventually been found by somebody in Gondor, right? With all of the length of the Anduin that flows through Gondor on its way to the sea, right?
Right.
So,
yeah.
The things would have likely been found by Gondor, and then it would have been known they would have been found, and those sorts of things. So,
gotcha.
Anyway,
yeah. Okay.
That's what he's saying there.
That makes sense.
Yeah. All right. So that's a little bit that's kind of a little chunk that comes after the narrative that explains, how we know that Isildur likely died in the wilderness near the Gladden Fields. Now, as far as these notes go, not every one of these notes is particularly interesting, but we're going to hit the high points. The first one that really stands out to me is note 7, where it talks about the Numenoreans and their relationship to horses and war. So note 7 reads, "The Numenoreans in their own land possessed horses, which they esteemed, but they did not use them in war, for all their wars were overseas. Also, they were of great stature and strength, and their fully equipped soldiers were accustomed to bear heavy armor and weapons. In their settlements on the shores of Middle-earth, they acquired and bred horses, but used them little for riding, except in sport and pleasure. In war, they were used only by couriers and by bodies of light-armed archers, often not of Numenorean race. In the War of the Alliance, such horses as they used had suffered great losses, and few were available in Osgiliath." So, they were not a people of accustomed to going to war with horses, right, on horseback.
Right. Yep.
They eventually found, found an alliance with the Rohirrim, who were into that sort of thing, but that was never a thing
for the Numenoreans. Which kind of makes sense, because, you think of them, Numenor is an island, so it definitely makes more sense that boats and stuff like that would be more their thing.
Right.
Than horses.
Yeah.
But
they liked horses, and they horses, but
sure.
they just didn't seem to use them in battle.
But they didn't know they were going off to battle here. They were just on a journey. Right,
but the point is that they didn't use them in like any of the battles, because they fought a lot of wars. They weren't a part of their martial arts.
Oh, just in general.
Yeah,
that wasn't their thing.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I remember talking about the reason that they took the route they did initially was because they didn't have any horses. They were on foot.
Yeah.
So that just I mean, yeah, so that makes sense. They yeah. They didn't use horses for much, it sounds like.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, next up is note 10. Meneldil was the nephew of Isildur. So Meneldil is the son of Anarion, who is Isildur's younger brother. Anarion, of course, dies in the Siege of Barad-dûr. But Meneldil is set up as the king of Gondor. And so it says, Isildur had established Meneldil as king of Gondor. Meneldil was a man of courtesy, but far-seeing, and he did not reveal his thoughts. He was, in fact, well-pleased by the departure of Isildur and his sons, and hoped that affairs in the north would keep them long occupied. It is stated in unpublished annals concerning the heirs of Elendil that Meneldil was the fourth child of Anarion, that he was born in the year 3318 of the Second Age, and that he was the last man to be born in Numenor. The note just cited is the only reference to his character. So he was happy to see, it's not clear if, you know, that he was up to, like, anything bad necessarily, but apparently he was just happy to have Isildur gone and maybe, you know, be able to be his own man in Gondor.
Was he mentioned in the narrative? He must have been. If this note is here.
Yeah, he's mentioned. It says, at the east gate of the bridge on a bright morning, Meneldil bade him farewell. Go now with good speed, okay, and may the sun of your setting out not cease to shine on your road.
This isn't implying, is it, that maybe Meneldil had anything to do with Isildur's disappearance? No,
I don't think so. I mean, there's nothing. Like I said, there doesn't seem to be anything sinister about him, other than maybe he's happy, you know, he's looking forward to being his own king instead of having the High King gazing over his shoulder all the time, right?
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily make you sinister to want that, right?
True. But it makes you human.
Exactly.
To be honest. Yeah.
Note 11 speaks more about Isildur's sons, who, of course, we talked a good bit about in the last episode. Specifically his three older sons, of course. Valandil is the youngest and is the only survivor and is, the forefather of Aragorn. It says all three of the older sons had fought in the War of the Alliance, but Aratan and Kirion had not been in the invasion of Mordor and the Siege of Barad-dûr, for Isildur had sent them to man his fortress of Minas Ithil, lest Sauron should escape Gil-galad and Elendil and seek to force a way through Cirith-duath, later called Cirith Ungol, and take vengeance on the Dúnedain before he was overcome. Elendur, Isildur's heir and dear to him, had accompanied his father throughout the war, save the last challenge upon Orodruin, and he was in Isildur's full confidence. It is stated in the annals mentioned in the last note that Isildur's eldest son was born in Numenor in the year 3299 of the Second Age. So, that's just an interesting little logistical note, is that Aratan and Kirion were basically put on during the siege of Barad-dûr. Isildur placed them on the western watch of Mordor to ensure that Sauron didn't try to make a break for it over Cirith Ungol into Gondor and wreak some last havoc on Gondor before, you know, he finally fell. So that was their role over there.
Mm-hmm.
So
interesting.
Yeah. Note 12, Aman Lank, the Naked Hill. We spoke a little bit last time about Dol Guldur and its proximity to all the bad things that happen here. Well, this Aman Lank is a reference to this hill upon which Dol Guldur would eventually come to be located. So, and, you know, again, they pass, it's right around when they pass this Aman Lank, Dol Guldur area that they start to run into trouble.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Let me get rid of my map. All right. Okay. Gladden Fields. A little bit about the Gladden Fields. In the elder days, why don't you go ahead and read this? 13.
Okay. In the elder days, when the Sylvan Elves first settled there, they were a lake formed in a deep depression, into which the Anduin poured from the north down the swiftest part of its course, a long descent of some 70 miles, and there mingled with the torrent of the Gladden River, hastening from the mountains. The lake had been wider west of the Anduin, for the eastern side of the valley was steeper, But on the east, it probably reached as far as the feet of the long slopes down from the forest, then still wooded, its reedy borders being marked by the gentler slope just below the path that Isildur was following. The lake had become a great marsh, through which the river wandered in a wilderness of islets and wide beds of reed and rush, and armies of yellow iris that grew taller than a man and gave their name to all the region and to the river from the mountains, about whose lower course they grew most thickly. But the marsh had receded to the east, and from the foot of the lower slopes there were now wide flats, grown with grass and small rushes, on which men could walk.
Okay. So just a little description of what the Gladden Fields actually looked like, right? How they actually would have appeared.
So they were pretty wet, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think we're intended to think of it as marsh, you know,
yeah,
kind of
marshy
a marshland,
land.
Right?
Yeah.
So
maybe Isildur like got sucked into quicksand.
well, then the Elendil.
Oh,
the
Elendil. That's
would
true
have been as well.
Oh,
right?
There goes that theory.
Yeah.
Oh well.
So. All right. Note 14 speaks of Orofer, right? Who is the Orofer is the king of the Sylvan Elves, and this goes back to long before the War of the Alliance. He's the king of the Sylvan Elves east of Anduin, being disturbed by rumors of the rising power of Sauron. He had left their ancient dwellings about Aemon Lonk, across the river from their kin in Lorien. Three times he had moved northwards, and at the end of the Second Age he dwelt in the western glens of the Aemon Dwyr, and his numerous people lived and roamed in the woods and vales westward as far as Anduin, north of the ancient dwarf road. He had joined the Alliance, but was slain in the assault upon the gates of Mordor. Thranduil, his son, had returned with the remnant of the army of the Sylvan Elves in the year before Isildur's march. So Orofer, we're speaking of the father of Thranduil, who, of course, is the father of Legolas. So, and really, we find out that Aemon Lonk, of course, this place where Dol Guldur, this hill where Dol Guldur will eventually come to be, was kind of the seat of the Sylvan Elves. For the better part of the Second Age, it sounds like, or at least for part of the Second Age. So that tells us that Aemon Lonk has a long history even before Sauron moves in, names it Dol Guldur and fortifies it in the Third Age.
Mm-hmm.
So, a little bit more, the Aemon Dwyr, aka the Dark Mountains, were a group of high hills in the northeast of the forest, so called because dense fir woods grew upon their slopes, but they were not yet of evil name. In later days, when the shadow of Sauron spread through Greenwood the Great and changed its name from Eren Galen to Tarnu Fuin, translated Mirkwood, the Aemon Dwyr became a haunt of many of his most evil creatures and were called Aemon Nu Fuin, the Mountains of Mirkwood.
So they passed very close to these, right? Are these the mountains that they were forced to kind of get closer to on their journey because of the Anduin kind of overrunning its borders?
I believe, so it says these are in the, excuse me, in the northeast of the forest. So that would mean, my map isn't cooperating here. Let me open it with a different application. Here we go.
I'm on the edge of my seat.
All right, yeah, so these mountains are located in the northeast of the forest.
Oh,
right?
Oh, so, I see.
Yeah, you're not talking about anything really close to where they would have been traveling.
Okay.
So
this is just FYI, like, it doesn't really pertain to the story much.
Well,
Does it?
I guess not.
No. I just wanted to make sure.
It's in the notes.
I know it's in the notes.
And it's just interesting to me to hear more about the history of Mirkwood and the geography of it.
Yeah, geography is always interesting to you.
Well, yeah.
And probably to a lot of people. So it's good that we're talking about it.
The Elvish names of the Mountains of Mirkwood are not found elsewhere. In Appendix F to the Lord of the Rings, the Elvish name of Mirkwood is Tar-e-Nidelos, Forest of the Great Fear. The name given here, Tar-nu-Fuin, Forest Under Night, was the later name of Dorthonion. the forested highland on the northern borders of Beleriand in the Elder Days. The application of the same name, Tar Nu Fuin, to both Mirkwood and Dorthonion is notable in the light of the close relation of Tolkien's pictures of them. After the end of the War of the Ring, Thranduil and Celeborn renamed Mirkwood once more, calling it Arryn Lasgallen, the Wood of Green Leaves. And then lastly on this note, Mini Nagrim, the Dwarf Road, is the old forest road described in the Hobbit Chapter 7. In the earlier draft of this section of the present narrative, there is a note referring to the ancient forest road that led down from the Pass of Imladris and crowned Anduin by a bridge, and so over the eastern valley into the Greenwood. The Anduin could not be bridged at any lower point. For a few miles below the forest road, the land fell steeply and the river became very swift until it reached the great basin of the Gladden Fields. Beyond the fields, it quickened again and was then a great flood fed by many streams, of which the names are forgotten save those of the larger, the Gladden, Silver Lode, and Limlight. In The Hobbit, the forest road traversed the great river by the old ford, and there is no mention of there having once been a bridge at the crossing. So, I like geography. Deal with it.
I'm dealing with it.
Yep.
In my own special way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
All right. This one is interesting, though.
I'm not so sure I can trust you anymore.
I'm just going to say that before everyone now. No, actually, this is a pretty short one. And apparently, there's some differences in the accounts of the Rings of Power in the Third Age and a few other sources from what's actually found in here. Some slight differences, one of which is mentioned in Note 15. And of the Rings of Power in the Third Age, it says, Isildur was overwhelmed by a host of orcs that lay in wait in the Misty Mountains, and they descended upon him at unawares in his camp between the Greenwood and the Great River, right nigh to Loig Ninglorán, the Gladden Fields, for he was heedless and set no guard, deeming that all his foes were overthrown. So, you can kind of say that, like, well, that's just, you know, that's just in the telling of it. It does obviously seem a little different from how it plays out in this story.
Yeah, it does.
But you might also argue that it's just somebody wrote that down for brevity. There's a lot. It's funny because I feel like there's a lot of issues like that in Of the Rings of Power in the Third Age, where things are just put in. They're put in such a. They're simplified so much that it leaves out a lot of the detail.
Hmm.
But I feel like that's not uncommon in anything, and doesn't necessarily mean that it's like an explicit contradiction, you know?
Right. Well, that's also not the focus of the Rings of Power. I mean, they're just kind of, I feel like the point of that part of the Silmarillion was just to kind of give an overview.
Yeah.
Of, you know, kind of hitting the high notes.
Exactly.
So this is probably just, obviously it's meant to be a summary.
Mm-hmm.
But it is interesting that it says that there were like a lot of orcs descended upon him unawares in his camp. Like he hadn't even given flight in this mm-hmm. account, right? So that is kind of a lot different,
yeah.
I think. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, it is, you were right. That one was interesting. Yeah. Good call.
Boom.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on.
All right. So, let's see. I'm going to skip to number 17 here. Otar. So we mentioned Otar as being one of the people who escaped, who lived to tell the tale, right?
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that Otar may not have been the proper name of this individual, because Otar simply means warrior or soldier.
Oh.
And it was the title of all who, though fully trained and experienced, had not yet been admitted to the rank of Rokan, a.k.a. knight. But Otar was dear to Isildur and of his own kin. So Otar was most likely just the name that Isildur called this individual at the time. Just you know, he's maybe addressing him as, you know, by his rank.
Or, yeah, by his role or
right.
his job. Yeah.
So he may have had another name, another actual proper name. Okay. But he was, okay. you know, he was apparent. He wasn't just some random dude either to Isildur. He,
right.
you know, he sent somebody who he trusted.
Got
so.
It.
Let's see. In so another note, so we mentioned Otar and then who was the other individual that we just mentioned a few minutes ago. It was Otar and Estelmir? Is that right?
I don't know.
Oh, I can't find his name.
Was he in a note?
Yeah, we talked about... Oh, Estelmo, that's right. Estelmo.
Oh, yes, Estelmo.
So we know of the two individuals, but apparently there were three. There's three mentioned that returned. In the earlier draft, Isildur directed Otar to take two companions with him. In Of the Rings of Power and the Third Age, in the Rings of Power and in the Fellowship of the Ring, it is told that three men only came ever back over the mountains. In the text given here, the implication is that the third was Estelmo, Elendur's esquire, who survived the battle. So,
okay. Wait, I thought, so who was the third person? So
well, we don't know. Like, so it sounds like Otar was told to bring either one or two companions with him.
Okay. And he took two, one of which was Estelmo.
Well, maybe, or...
Oh, that's just implied, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, you know, you think about a lot of this, and you can see how people, a lot of it's... a lot of these discrepancies are probably just attributable to Tolkien not having his own story straight when he goes to expand upon a particular aspect of the entire narrative, right?
Right.
But you can also see how that aligns with how, you know, we come to learn things throughout history too, and people can remember it. Oh, there were three people that came. Okay, mm-hmm. Well, he said that three people, you know, he said that three people escaped together, right, and lived to tell the tale. You know, and we know that this person said Otar was sent with two companions, and it's like, okay, well, but how do we know that Otar was sent with two companions? Or maybe there were just three people that came and escaped, and one of them was with Otar and one of them was separate, right?
Yeah.
So you can see how, like,
yeah, that kind of stuff can get a
even,
little...
I mean, even today, just when you talk about eyewitness accounts and how do we know what we know?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That gets very... That can get very, very tricky.
Absolutely. Tricky was the word I was going to use, too.
Yeah.
Yep.
20, I find very interesting. This is on where the orcs came from.
Okay.
So do you want to read this?
Sure. There can be no doubt that Sauron, well informed of the Alliance, had sent out such orc troops of the Red Eye as he could spare to do what they could to harry any forces that attempted to shorten their road by crossing the mountains. In the event, the main might of Gil-galad, together with Isildur and part of the men of Arnor, had come over the passes of Imeldris and Cadarath, and the orcs were dismayed and hid themselves. But they remained alert and watchful, determined to attack any companies of elves or men that they outnumbered. Thranduil they had let pass, for even his diminished army was far too strong for them. But they bided their time, for the most part hidden in the forest, while others lurked along the river banks. It is unlikely that any news of Sauron's fall had reached them, for he had been straitly besieged in Mordor, and all his forces had been destroyed. If any few had escaped, they had fled far to the east with the Ringwraiths. This small detachment in the north of no account was forgotten. Probably they thought that Sauron had been victorious, and the war-scarred army of Thranduil was retreating to hide in fastnesses of the forest. Thus they would be emboldened and eager to win their master's praise, though they had not been in the main battles. But it was not his praise they would have won, if any had lived long enough to see his revival. No tortures would have satisfied his anger with the bungling fools who had let slip the greatest prize in Middle-earth, even though they could know nothing of the One Ring, which, save to Sauron himself, was known only to the nine Ringwraiths, its slaves. Yet many have thought that the ferocity and determination of their assault on Isildur was in part due to the ring. It was little more than 2 years since it had left his hand, and though it was swiftly cooling, it was still heavy with his evil will, and seeking all means to return to its lord, as it did again when he recovered and was rehoused. So it is thought, although they did not understand, and the orc chiefs, the orc chiefs were filled with a fierce desire to destroy the Dúnedain and capture their leader. Nonetheless, it proved in the event that the War of the Ring was lost at the disaster of the Gladden Fields.
Yeah, so so it would seem that these orcs were planted here to harass people on the way to war, and you know, several years prior to this event, and they didn't really do much about that, but they were still there afterwards, and they didn't know that Sauron had fallen, and the ring itself may have been calling to them in its own way, right? And that, you know, partly maybe why they didn't mess with Thranduil's forces too much when they came by before. They might have just been a little bit more afraid of the elves as well, but they do go after them. You know, they do go after them here, and that's partly, you know, it seems like it has to have something to do with the presence of the ring in this case. I do find it, a couple of notes on it I do find really interesting. So first is the thought that no tortures would have, like, they think, you know, surely they, if they would have captured this, or, you know, if they would have, you know, they were thinking to themselves, like, Sauron's going to be very happy with us when we kill these Numenoreans. But then it says, no tortures would have satisfied his anger with the bungling fools who had let slip the greatest prize in Middle-earth, even though they could know nothing of the One Ring, which, save to Sauron himself, was known only to the Nine Ring Wraiths, its slaves. So they, you know, they would have been all proud of themselves, but Sauron would have been like, you idiots, and would have probably scourged them all, and, you know, for letting the ring get away, right? And then again, I thought this note, I had to read it a couple of times to understand what it was saying at the very end. Nonetheless, it proved in the event that the War of the Ring was lost at the disaster of the Gladden Fields, meaning that the War of the Ring was lost for Sauron, right, at the disaster of the Gladden Fields, because
they failed to...
Isildur escaped.
Mm.
Enough to ensure that the ring didn't fall into their hands.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
And never would get back to Sauron.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. That is interesting.
Yeah.
I also thought it was interesting that they didn't attack every army that came by. Only the ones that they outnumbered. Which they were clearly, even Thranduil, even though he had taken some hits in war, was still stronger than the orcs. So they just let them go.
Yeah.
So the orcs are kind of, they're kind of wussy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
they have a big bark, not much bite.
Well, yeah, but, you know, and you can, I think the strength of orcs is often just in their numbers, right? They're not.
That's true.
You know, especially like your average orc, it would seem. Now you can maybe argue that there's certain breeds of orcs that are, you know, a little more, who fare a little better on the battlefield, like the Uruk-hai, right?
Yeah.
But it would seem that the average orc, right, their strength is in their numbers, and they want to, you know, they want to be able to just, they just kind of overcome you by swarming you, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it talks about, in the narrative, it talked about, you know, 5-1, 10-1 losses being acceptable to them.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So.
Oh, yes.
And achieving a victory.
Risk. Yes.
Yeah. So, 23, quick note on the description of the ring, the ring's heat. It says, compare the words of the scroll which Isildur wrote concerning the ring before he departed from Gondor on his last journey, in which Gandalf reported to the Council of Elrond in Rivendell. It was hot when I first took it, hot as a gleed, and my hand was scorched, so that I doubt if ever again I shall be free of the pain of it. Yet even as I write it, it is cooled, and it seemeth to shrink. So I had to look up what this word gleed meant, because I had not seen this word before. And it's a Old English word, and it's apparently has something to do with a burning coal or an ember, right? So, you know, basically it's as hot as an ember you'd pick up from a fire, right?
It's pretty
so
hot.
It's going to burn you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. So that's the hotness of the ring. There you go.
Hot ring.
Hot ring. Let's see. the light of the Elendilmir. The meaning, sufficiently remarkable, of this passage appears to be that the light of the Elendilmir was proof against the invisibility conferred by the One Ring when worn, if its light would be visible were the ring not worn. But when Isildur covered his head with a hood, its light was extinguished.
Hmm.
So, yeah, the Elendilmir was apparently bright enough that even the One Ring could not obscure it, but your average hood could. So
that doesn't make sense.
Why not? It just means I think that the magic of the ring, right? Whatever the special magic of the ring.
The magic of the ring was not more powerful than the magic of the Elendilmir.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's fair. That's fair.
So, let's see. I'm going to jump forward to the very last two notes. So 32 and 33. 32, it is told in Aldarion and Arrendis that Arrendis caused the diamond which Aldarion brought to her from Middle-earth to be set as a star in a silver fillet. And at her asking, he bound it on her forehead. For this reason, she was known as Tar Elestirne, the Lady of the Starbrow. And thus came, it is said, the manner of the kings and queens afterward to wear as a star a white jewel upon the brow, and they had no crown. This tradition cannot be unconnected with that of the Elendilmir, a star-like gem born on the brow as a token of royalty in Arnor. But the original Elendilmir itself, since it belonged to Silmarion, was in existence in Numenor, whatever its origin may have been, before Aldarion brought Arrendis's jewel from Middle-earth, and they cannot be the same. So, the Elendilmir that I believe is... So basically, there are at least two Elendilmir, right? There's the one that belonged to Isildur here and is lost for a long time until it's recovered by Elessar in Orthanc at the end of the War of the Ring.
Mm-hmm.
But Elessar also has another Elendilmir, right, which is worn by all of the descendants of Valandil down to him. Right.
Okay.
So, and I believe that is the Elendilmir of Silmarion, right? So who is one of the figures that goes back far in the history of Numenor and actually precedes Aldarion and Arrendis. I'm just going to look this up.
So which one would it have been that Isildur had then?
So that's what I'm trying to determine here. So let's see. Elendilmir. Let's see. When King Elendil's eldest son Isildur and the Dúnedain of Arnor were marching home, only three survived, excluding Isildur. Elendilmir would have been lost with him in the Gladden River. So, okay, another version of this gemstone was made at a later date by Isildur's descendants, a second Elendilmir, commemorating King Elendil and Isildur himself. It was born roughly around Third Age 2940, or most likely later.
So he would have had the original one. Isildur would have.
Yes, Isildur would have had the original Silmarion Elendilmir. That's correct. So, mm-hmm. And whatever is being the one being referred to in Aldarion and Arrendis is actually separate from that one. And then there was another one that was made in place of Isildur's.
So there's
pass
actually
on.
Three.
It would seem so.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And then this is a nice one. This is a nice note to end it on. You'll recall one of the curios from our episode on the history of the Third Age, when we talked about the Fourth Age, was with Sam receiving the Star of the Dúnedain, right?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And you might think that with the name of, this, you know, this the Star of Elendil, that this is like another name for the Star of the Dúnedain, right? This is like some kind of, you know, did Elessar give Sam the Elendilmir? It's like, wow, that would be a pretty incredible gift to him. But something about that just doesn't seem right. So this note actually weighs in authoritatively on that. It says, so this is Christopher speaking. He says, in the Tale of Years in Appendix B to the Lord of the Rings, the entry for the year 16 of the Fourth Age states that when King Ilaesar came to the Brandywine Bridge to greet his friends, he gave the Star of the Dúnedain to Master Samwise, while his daughter Eleanor was made a maid of honor to Queen Arwen. On the basis of this record, Mr. Robert Foster says in The Complete Guide to Middle-earth that the Star of Elendil was worn on the brow of the kings of the Northern Kingdom until Ilaesar gave it to Sam Gamgee in 4th Age 16. The clear implication of the present passage is that King Ilaesar retained indefinitely the Elendilmir that was made for Valandil, and it seems to me in any case out of the question that he would have made a gift of it to the mayor of the Shire, however greatly he esteemed him. The Elendilmir is called by several names, the Star of Elendil, the Star of the North, the Star of the North Kingdom, and the Star of the Dúnedain, occurring only in this entry in the Tale of Years, is assumed to be yet another both in Robert Foster's guide and in J.A. Taylor's Tolkien Companion. I have found no other reference to it, but it seems to me to be almost certain that it was not, and that Master Samwise received some different and more suitable distinction.
That makes sense.
So I thought it was interesting that the names of these tokens seem to bear, you know, seem so similar. But the Star of the Dúnedain must have just been some kind of like it's almost like a medal of service, right? Mm-hmm. Like a distinguished medal, but like basically, you know, like in military terms, an award given to somebody who has really distinguished themselves in service to,
yeah,
you know, a cause, right?
Right.
So something like the Medal of Honor, right?
Yes. Yes.
So I think that must be what the Star of Dúnedain, Star of the Dúnedain refers to.
Not the Elendilmir.
Not the Elendilmir. It just doesn't seem, I mean, it would be amazing, but it just seems almost unfitting.
It does. I mean, Sam's awesome and all. Nothing against Sam, but he's not a king.
Right. Right.
And he's not descended from the Dúnedain.
Yeah, it would almost be to like, I don't know. It just, it doesn't make sense that even like somebody who, you know, as wonderful as Ilaesar would, you know, would do that.
Right. Yeah. Like it just seems over the top.
Like that would, exactly. It seems over the top. Like everybody would be like, what are you doing? That's right. Just wrong.
Because it is right. Like it's rightfully his as the king, you know? And it's basically, I mean, did I misunderstand? But it sounds like this was worn in place of a crown.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be like giving Sam a crown. You don't give a mayor a crown.
Yeah.
It's for kings and queens.
That's right.
Even princesses don't wear crowns. They wear tiaras.
Well.
So, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, this makes sense to me. It would have been something different. So
cool.
I agree. You have my stamp of approval on that.
All right. Well, excellent.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, the last bit in here is about linear measurements. So as fascinating as that sounds, I'll let you all go look that up. So, you know, there's interesting stuff in there.
Oh, I'm sure there is. Yeah.
But Greta might strangle me if I start to speak about any of that.
I know. Sorry, I'm not the nerd that you are.
So that's all for the Disaster of the Gladden Fields. I hope you've enjoyed this two-part series and drop us a line with your own thoughts and insights.
Yeah, as always.
All right, well, let's do some correspondence.
Let's do it.
First off, I want to mention a nice review we received on iTunes here recently. Pull that bad boy up here. Lord of the Rings Love, 5 stars. If you love Tolkien, no, I mean really love Tolkien, this is for you. I am so grateful for this podcast. Keep up the good work. And you, go listen.
Awesome.
That is from Lion MML, is what it looks like.
Cool. Thanks, Lion MML.
Yeah, thank
That's
you
some
very
serious
much.
Love.
Well, I'm.
We love that.
I'm so grateful that you're grateful.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that you said, like, if you love Tolkien, no, I mean really love Tolkien.
Like all
this
caps
is for you, right?
Yep.
We are the podcast. We are the Tolkien podcast for people who really, really love Tolkien.
Like capital R-E-A-L-L-Y.
You know, other podcasts out there might be like, well, we're the podcast if you like Tolkien. We're like, no. If you just like Tolkien, get out of our face. This is the Tolkien podcast for people who really, really love Tolkien.
Yep. You're set apart.
I mean,
as the real lovers of Tolkien.
Don't even come in here with some of that like, well, I enjoy some Tolkien now and then.
John, we're open to all Tolkien fans. I don't want to ostracize anybody.
I'll ostracize you.
No, don't ostracize me. Just because I don't love geography
we are
like
the Tolkien,
you do.
We are the podcast for people who really, really, really love Tolkien.
And we're also for the podcast for the people that like Tolkien, too. Yeah. I just want everyone to feel welcome. All are welcome.
Mm, no. unless you can declare love for Tolkien, you are not worthy of this podcast.
John, we may have just lost some listeners.
I'm drawing a line. Line at MML has inspired me.
Okay. All right.
That's who we are.
Fair enough.
That is who we are.
Okay. John has spoken.
Deal with it. Mic drop.
The sunglasses are also falling onto his face as we speak from the sky.
That's right.
Yep. They just magically appeared. I don't know where they came from.
Thank you for that awesome comment.
Yes,
line
that was
MML.
Really awesome.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We have a couple of notes to discuss. So the first we will discuss is from Joey S.
Joey.
Patron. All-around amazing person.
Mm-hmm.
Joey says, and I believe this in reference to our episode 214 on the Gladden Fields Part 1. He says, excellent episode. These tales are so exciting to hear when you have not been exposed to them before. It's extra goodness that gives background for events we all know but did not understand how or why they came about. I found it interesting as well, John, about the orcs surrounding the men in a ring shape. I also found it very interesting that the orcs strategized following their first attempt. Whereas most of the time, orcs seem mindless and otherwise unable to strategize unless someone else is pulling the strings. I feel it's because of the strong hatred for men, along with the ring in Isildur's possession. Evil is drawn to it, and the ring wants to be found. Who knows if they felt pulled towards the men initially because of what was drawing near or who was drawing near. Maybe it's both, with one probable cause that's more of an underlying presence. The orcs did not know directly that the ring was before them, I'm sure, but evil is drawn to evil. When you stack that upon pure hatred, I can see now why they would try any attempt to isolate the men and slowly cripple their forces. I really enjoyed this one and look forward to more. God bless.
Awesome. Good stuff.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Thank you, Joey.
Thanks, Joey. And then our last note for this week is from Marilyn the Librarian.
Marilyn.
Yes.
Awesome.
On October 27th, Marilyn wrote and said, I got to skip ahead a little bit. All right. So now for the Numenor episode. If you'd like to go, if you'd like to do a deep dive into how the notion of Numenor grew and developed in Tolkien over time, then you might want to look at The Lost Road in the fifth volume of the Histories of Middle-earth and the Notion Club papers published in Sauron Defeated, Volume 9. They are both quite different from each other and from a Calibeth, but the common threads are interesting and sometimes even moving, a lot about fathers and sons. Also, look at Tolkien's letters numbers 163, 252, 257, and 276. Lots of cool material on his understanding of moral falls. It's interesting, you know, the bit about fathers and sons and knowing the dynamic that Tolkien's own sons played in the development of Middle-earth.
Hmm.
You know, especially Christopher.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think all of his sons and maybe his daughter as well, you know, had their own roles in kind of providing feedback and those sorts of things. She goes on to say, it is an interesting question why the Valar forsook the Atani for so long. My only thought is only Eru is perfect. Also interesting is the idea that humans are more connected to Eru and elves to the Valar. It fits the ultimate destinies of the two kindred children, certainly, so far as we are told. The second prophecy of Mondo's concerning the Dagor Dagoroth, the last battle, does refer to some different outcomes. See the War of the Jewels, the last chapters of the Quaint of Silmarillion. Christopher chose to omit this from his editing of the Silmarillion, but some Tolkien scholars felt that this was a misunderstanding of Tolkien's intent. It's a vivid story, and much in keeping with both Christian and Norse ideas of the ending of the world. And as for why the Numenoreans have very few children, can you imagine the overpopulation problem of a people that live for several hundred years and have many children? It's just not that big an island. That's a good point.
That is a very good point.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that.
And then she responds to one of our commenters from last week regarding a question about Zoroastrianism and Tolkien's knowledge of it. She says, regarding Persian Zoroastrianism, loved that listener email. It's certainly true that Tolkien, as an author, wrote about the conflict between good and evil, but as a Catholic, he was not a dualist. For him, as he depicted in his works, there is one, Eru, who is good, and evil comes about when created things use their free will in harmful ways. It's certainly possible that Tolkien knew something of Zoroastrianism. The Birmingham Oratory, where his guardian, Father Francis, was attached, has an extensive library, and the Oratorians were certainly involved in scholarship as well as contemporary issues of theology. And as a medievalist and scholar, Tolkien would have read widely, particularly around those kinds of questions. But I can't find anyone claiming any evidence about it one way or the other. Yeah, and that's kind of where we landed too. You know, there doesn't really seem to be much. Tolkien doesn't seem to have written much on the subject of Zoroastrianism anywhere that I can speak of. So it's certainly possible that he knew of it and even read some of it, and was knowledgeable of it, he doesn't speak of it anywhere as being a direct influence. She goes on to say, Isildur wanted to return to Rivendell for Elrond's council, as you said, but he didn't need to tell Elrond he had taken the ring. Elrond was the one, along with Círdan, who tried hard to get him to destroy it right after he took it. And I was struck this time by the power of listening to the text instead of reading it, as I realized for the first time the parallels between Isildur and Boromir. Both craved the ring, believing in their pride that they were strong enough to master it. Both repented of it. Both were killed in the aftermath. I wonder if Tolkien was doing a bit of retconning here, along with his story of Isildur saving a fruit from the Tree of Numenor. Otherwise, Isildur is no more than a guy who refused to destroy the ring, and thus somewhat problematic as an ancestor to honor and respect. Yeah, you know, I think it's good that we find out that there's a lot more to Isildur, like there is a lot more to Boromir, right?
Mm-hmm.
Than just, you know, the failure for which they're most famous.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
There's a lot more to be said for both individuals, and, you know, hopefully for each of us at the end of our lives, despite our failures, you know, people who know us best will be able to look at us and say, you know, they might have had these glaring failures, but you know what? They also had these incredible virtues that are worth remembering and that they deserve to be remembered for,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
There were these times when they stuck their necks out when no one else was, and, you know, and were seeking to do the right thing when no one else was.
Right.
So you need to remember that, you know, you need to take the good with the bad. So,
and in a way, I mean, both Isildur and Boromir, you could say, were types of martyrs, because they ended up dying
mm-hmm.
for, you know, after they repented of their, you know, of wanting the ring.
Yeah.
They both died, as Marilyn mentioned, like as a, they gave themselves up to save or trying to save. What
yeah.
was important.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. Like it's easy just on a high level to say of both of them, like, well, Boromir tried to steal the ring from Frodo and Isildur should have destroyed the ring when he had the chance and didn't. And so they got what was coming to him,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
But the truth is much more complex in that
for sure.
both
yeah.
of them, even though it was, you can kind of be like, well, it's kind of too late, too little too late,
yeah.
maybe.
Yeah.
For
at least
them,
they tried.
For them personally, but yeah, and like they did try. Like they
mm-hmm.
really, you know, when they realized what horrible mistakes they made, they gave it their everything to try and save the day in what way they could.
Right.
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 You know, Isildur tries to make a break for it and to bring the ring to safety.
Mm-hmm.
And for his effort, even though he dies in the wilderness, he manages to keep the ring out of Sauron's hands,
mm-hmm.
and eventually, like they said in the story, right, or like they said in the note we read, his action, it won just the fact that he was able to flee from these orcs and die in the wilderness and make sure the ring didn't fall into their hands, won the War of the Ring for them, right?
Right.
That was the deciding factor in the War
right.
of the Ring.
Yeah.
3,000 years before it happened.
Yeah. So. Yeah. That was it. He defeated Sauron right then and there.
Yeah. So, good point.
For
great
a second
point.
Time. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. It also occurred to me that one could argue that the east wind, which brought the heavy rains and altered Isildur's course that night, could actually be a blessing from Manwë or even Eru. Think what Isildur could have become if he had survived that night with the ring. It would have perverted his pride and strength. He almost certainly would have become another evil lord. I have to imagine there would have been intense strife between Numenoreans and elves. The elven rings would have been under Isildur's control. Instead, Isildur is able to redeem himself in the end and die mostly uncorrupted, though his death and the treatment of his body is ignominious. The ring is removed from anyone's possession for roughly 2,500 years, hidden in a place where eventually it can be found by a proto-hobbit. I think of hobbits as Eru's secret plan for overcoming Sauron, and said early hobbit then hides himself in the ring for another 500 years or so in a place where it can then be picked up by the safest possible keeper, Bilbo Baggins of the Shire. And Bilbo will have as his heir the only person who could have brought about the ring's destruction. Sounds like sacred design to me.
Indeed.
Yeah. And a note, the shards of Narsil certainly sounds like several pieces, certainly since shards may make one think of shreds. But during the Council of Elrond, Aragorn cast his sword upon the table that stood before Elrond, and the blade was in two pieces. Swords of that nature rarely shatter because they were poorly made, or they were stuck into ring wraiths. They could be broken by a particularly strong blow, but again, we're told that the sword broke into two pieces when Elendil fell and Narsil fell beneath him, not when Elendil stuck it into Sauron, which I very much doubt he ever did, in fact. The Silmarillion says that Sauron wrestled with Gil-galad and Elendil, and both were killed, but so was Sauron's body, and Isildur cut the ring from Sauron's hand and the hilt shard of Narsil. I'm afraid the movie really messed up people's notions of this. Meaning, too many shards.
It was really only two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then lastly, she says, I loved all of Jonathan's bird knowledge. Do you ask him what he knows about black swans? So Jonathan, hope you're listening. Do you ask him what he knows about black swans seen during the boat journey down the Anduin in Fellowship and about crows from Dunland? I don't think they are forest birds as much, but I don't know for sure. Blessings on your paths, Marilyn.
Yeah, Marilyn always has such great insights.
Yep.
Good, good, good stuff.
Knowledge bombs.
Knowledge
galore.
Bombs, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about boom.
Boom, 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 boom. All right. Well, that is the end of the episode.
All right. Well, we did it.
We did it. All right. Hey, we'd love to hear from any and all. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com. Website, Facebook, Twitter, etc. Only if you are a Tolkien lover. If you really, really, really love Tolkien.
Really, really, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Also, if you just like him,
mm.
You can still write. Because I said so.
Mm. I'll make Greta read those. If you say Tolkien liker,
I guess Tolkien's okay.
Yeah.
Then I'll have Greta read those notes.
That's fine.
Future.
That's fine. Yeah. Like, I can handle that. I think.
I'll just seethe over here.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Special thanks to our patrons who all love Tolkien and are amazing people. Shannon S.
Brian O.
Emilio P.
Zeke F.
James A.
James L.
Chris L.
Chuck F.
Azia V.
Ish of the Hammer.
Teresa C.
David of Pint with Jack.
Jonathan D.
Eric S.
Joey S.
Eric B.
Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien.
Matt L.
Johanna T.
Todd G.
Ms. Anonymous.
And Sam N.
Yes, and I should say those are not all of our patrons, but those are our patrons of a certain order. So, yes.
Okay.
So, all of our patrons, of our patrons are...
all
amazing.
Tolkien
lovers.
They are.
Mm-hmm.
And they're awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Thank you to all of you.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.